I'm Kate Redmond. On this week's Local Motion, I interview author Kara Judea Al-Hadef, who wrote Zazu Dreams, Between the Scarab and the Dung Beetle, a cautionary fable for the Anthropocene era. It is illustrated by Michaela Amatu Amato, who also happens to be Kara's mother. Al-Hadef holds a PhD from European Graduate School in Switzerland and has written several books and published dozens of interdisciplinary essays. She lives now in Paonia and took time out to come down to the studio and talk to me. On the front of your book, you say, as told to.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that.
So this is really a story about more than just a singular family. This is a story about humanity over the ages, cross-cultural storytelling. And the as told to is as though a child is speaking to his mother, is telling her his dreams that relate to the stories that he's heard growing up from his family members over the years about their experiences in various lands as a diasporic peoples. So the idea is not that I, as the author, am the author, but that I'm almost like a conduit and sharing the story of many through my son's experiences, through Zazu's experiences. So it's really about global voices, voices of refugees, voices of those forced to migrate from all over the world and across time.
An oral tradition.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I want to describe for our listeners the appearance of the book, because it's so large in your hands, and the illustrations are sweeping and florid, and often the text wraps around them. So this is a children's book.
Well, it's actually a fable for adults. One of the reasons it's written as in the form, to a degree, in the form of a children's narrative is because the issues that I'm exploring are so controversial, so painful in terms of climate justice, in terms of environmental racism, green colonialism, greenwashing, so many horrors against both humanity and our natural world. I was looking for a way of exploring these issues that would be less confrontational, less threatening. So I wrote it to a degree in the framework of a children's narrative. And at the same time, I want to bring to the forefront the idea of beauty as not something that is relegated just to children's world, a children's framework or children's perspective, but the beauty of and playfulness that the images offer. But it is interpreted on the cover as, because of the framework, it's a coffee table book, and also the illustrations, that it is for children. But in fact, it's an intergenerational book, and specifically for adults to share with other, with young children, with young adults. And because the endnotes are a significant portion, there's about 400 endnotes of economic, literary, historical, environmental science references. So it's a dialogue, and the book is written so that people can really choose to highlight various aspects that are relevant to their histories in relation to these more connected issues of climate crisis.
Arun Gandhi described your book as a new genre called edutainment.
Yes.
So you really do get wrapped in by the fable and by the beautiful illustrations, but it's so heavily annotated that there's a ton of information in there, and it's very highly researched.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm happy that you're bringing up Arun. He's one of the many endorsers, including Noam Chomsky and Bill McKibben, Paul Hawken, Eve Ensler, Shakchi Humpty Hump, Zazu's uncle, James E. Hansen. So activists, artists, and Arun, who's Mahatma Gandhi's grandson, we met. And the idea of edutainment, because he's coming from a place of his own history as being Gandhi's grandson. And how do we, through storytelling, through a sense of intimacy, how do we address these incredibly loaded, complicated political issues, realities? And I think really one way is through imagery and storytelling and what is considered to a degree entertainment.
The protagonist, Zazu, hopes we will reconsider the words, this is from your book, of the Egyptian scholar Andre Asiman, who said, to be a Jew is to be in exile. Zazu wants us to know that to be a Jew is to practice tikkun olam. Can you explain the central belief of this practice?
Tikkun olam is a Hebrew term meaning, one translation is repair of the world. So the idea of we're living within a shattered vessel, and to bring the pieces back together, how do we learn from history? How do we learn from one another cross-culturally today in order to heal both culturally and our bodies, our planet body and our human bodies, wildlife body? And how does that become a practice, both acknowledging the struggle and the pain and a practice of joy by recognizing our interconnectedness?
And can you also address Dal Tashit?
Dal Tashit. So that's, again, one variation, one translation is do not destroy or waste. So, and biblically, there's all kinds of manifestations of how that is, what that has meant historically for Jews. But it originally has to do with trees and respecting the life of trees. And I'm appropriating that in the context of seeing how we see people and objects in industrial capitalist culture, how we see so many people and objects as disposable, as waste. And when we do that, what are the implications globally? So that when we develop a sense of respect for objects, for other people, for difference, how that then affects, of course, global issues of climate and environmental, humanitarian concerns.
Your book has 55 pages of endnotes. Do you know of another children's book that is so annotated?
Well, I don't. I'm a little obsessed with endnotes. My first book is Viscous Expectations, Justice, Vulnerability, the Obscene. And that, I think, it's a 600-page book. It's a philosophy book, interdisciplinary philosophy book. But again, many, many footnotes. And one reason is because what I'm interested in is dialogue. And again, this being a fable for adults, and how do we use tales, parables, fables as a form of education? And how do we use dialogue then, not as we're coming from a top-down, this is information, data that you need to ingest in order to then take action, but how do you feel a sense of intimacy with these issues, with these realities of climate crisis and environmental racism? And for me, the endnotes and this intense annotation is really about highlighting possibility for dialogue so that people can feel their own sense of vulnerability and empowerment and see this back and forth between the sciences and the humanities, between deeply personal narrative and historical events that may seem unrelated to our families or to our daily lives even. And for me, the annotations really are about highlighting that connective tissue. And that's why there's so many, and it's really about deeply exploring a sense of responsibility, mutual responsibility, both playful and with deep, deep, serious commitment.
And you've named the endnotes, the 21st Century Arcades Project. Yeah. There's a reference in there. Can you tell our listeners what that is?
Walter Benjamin was someone who was a Jewish philosopher who died at the end of World War II, I think while he was hiding from the Nazis. And he's well known for his Arcades Project, an involved historical research project that is very much to me about storytelling and re-envisioning history through imagination and experience.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with author, activist, and parent Kara Judea Al-Hadef about her book, Zazu Dreams, Between the Scarab and the Dung Beetle, a cautionary fable for the Anthropocene era. This is Local Motion. I'm Kate Redmond. Zazu, the young protagonist, goes on journeys in the book. In his dreams, he and his husky, Coco Miso, meet his ancestors. Through Zazu's journeys, you tell the stories of the many diasporas of the Jewish people. Can you talk about some of the journeys that he goes on?
Yeah. So his family is Arab Jewish, Sephardic, so Spanish Jewish, in distinction, if we're going to have binaries, with Ashkenazic Jews, Eastern European German Jews. And this is not a story just about this contained ethnic group. It's really about cultural extinction of ethnic others in general. It's a departure point for looking at, as I said before, refugees historically. The idea of multiplicity, that there are so many, that we can look at someone and we can think that we understand, we may know that their specific background is, in this case, Jewish, for example, but without understanding that there are such a range of histories. And if we understand, if we begin to see each other in our extraordinary diversity, each and every one of us, perhaps we can also understand ourselves better and understand that the challenges, the conflicts, the political conflicts that we're trying to address, that we're trying to collectively act on, that we have more foothold than we may otherwise imagine. So that when he goes on his adventures, he goes to places where Jews come from, where we don't think of them as coming from in the United States. He goes to places where my family comes from, Turkey, the island of Rhodes, Iran, Iraq, Morocco, places that are much more associated with Arab or Muslim cultures, Persian cultures. And he's learning the relationships between their vulnerability and their sense of extraordinary power and extraordinary sense of community, and how they work together symbiotically in the face of various forms of oppression. So he's traveling, for example, he sees the relationship between water issues in 9th century Iran with what happened here in Flint, Michigan in 2015 with the lead poisoning. So it's this weaving, and as he is exploring his dreams and seeing those connections between humanitarian abuses and ecological collapse, and then seeing examples of symbiosis, he's understanding where his place now is in the world and how he can not feel paralyzed by the horrors.
Overwhelming nature of human brutality.
Yeah, and how the Anthropocene, how human-induced consumerism and convenience culture has taken over, industrialization has taken over, but how we can actually begin to coexist through a sense of respect and learning how we can live through mutual responsibility and mutual accountability by looking at these examples architecturally, in terms of agriculture, engineering in these other time periods, other cultures throughout the Middle East, for example. And he also goes to India and the Caribbean, where Jewish communities come from.
Well, I resonated with a chapter on Cochin.
Oh, yes.
Because I've been to India and the state of Kerala all the way to the southern tip, and I've been to Cochin. Beautiful. And as I wandered the city, I happened into the Jewish quarter. It was populated by craftspeople, mostly wood carvers, doing very ornate work, doors and folding screens and reliefs. And that was when I first learned that there are Jews in India.
Yes, yes. Yeah, they're the oldest Jewish community comes from Cochin.
And they came in the 15th century during one of the first pogroms, yes?
Expulsions, yeah, yeah. Pogrom refers to the Russian horrors, brutalities, and the expulsions
is more specific.
To Sephardic, yeah, having been expelled from Spain in 1492, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that community seems to be very, very together, very strong.
In India, from what you saw in Cochin. Oh, beautiful. Oh, fantastic. I haven't had that experience. There's enforced ghettoization and also voluntary ghettoization in terms of wanting to maintain one's culture. Definitely there's that strength. One of the differences between Sephardic Jews and Arab Jews and, on the other hand, Ashkenazic Jews is the integration, and that is reflected in their language, in the language of Ladino. For example, it's one of the most hybrid languages that I'm familiar with, a combination of 15th century Spanish with Hebrew, Arabic, Farsi, Turkish, depending on where the Jews fled to. I like to use that also as a symbol or as a metaphor in terms of, again, these multiplicities. And when we are coming from a multicultural perspective, how that strengthens us. You can have this incredibly strong, tightly knit community and be fully integrated into your quote-unquote host culture and not just be seen as a parasite or as, you know, an isolated, ghettoized group. And that's one of the beauties, I think, of, in this case, the Sephardic people.
You talk a lot about food and specific foods that Zazu's phantasmagorical hosts serve up.
Yeah, food as a connecting element, both in terms of our sensuality and how that also feeds a desire for people to explore other cultural realms.
And there's also Ladino in the book.
Yes, yeah, the proverbs are spoken throughout. And when we perform this, because we perform it in our last major performance was at the Planetarium at CU in Boulder, or science centers, libraries, cultural centers, off the grid events, a lot of climate events, food waste solution symposiums. And we always include someone who speaks Spanish or Arabic or Farsi or Hebrew to perform those proverbs. And the proverbs are basically all about working and living together and how can we remind ourselves of community.
Would you mind reading from some of the book?
So let's see, a lot of my focus these days is on questioning renewable energies, quote unquote, and I would say that they are not renewable given the carbon intensive nature of solar and wind, for example. And so that's a huge discussion, I know, but I'm going to read a section that is in relation to greenwashing and the green economy. And this is a very short section. And I just want to say, too, the way the book is written is narrative and image. And as you shared, Kate, it's heavily, heavily annotated. So reading it is always an interesting challenge in terms of, do we read just the narrative or do we go back and forth between the endnotes and the narrative? When we perform it, we do go back and forth. And we have all kinds of ways of sharing those different voices. For now, I'm just going to read very short piece of the narrative. And it starts with a Ladino proverb, which is, bargains aren't always bargains. Yes, Zazu. Our Sephardic ancestors understood these kinds of contradictions. Even if we create alternatives to fossil fuels, Jurassic poop, what if renewable energies become big business and just maintain our addiction to consumption and convenience culture? Replacing tar sands or oil drills or coal power plants with megalithic green energy is not the solution, green is in quotes. It just masks the original problem, confusing freedom, quote unquote, with free market and free enterprise. Industrial-sized solar energy development is stripping the land bare, ravaging the already extremely vulnerable wildlife. And I have many footnotes in there to explore what it is that I'm speaking about.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Zazu not only visits his ancestors that are blood relatives, but also his ancestors in resistance and in defense of the environment. So through Zazu's eyes, we get to see the work of Gandhi, of Jacques Cousteau. How did you choose which heroes to focus on?
Wow. Yeah, I get goosebumps with your question. Luckily, for all of us, there are so many, right? Historic. I'm gonna cry. we have so many models out there cross culturally. Wow, I really do have goosebumps. What I chose were many Jewish or Persian or Arabic healers, physicians, scientists, but also people like Rachel Carson and Stephen Hawking, for example. They merged into one person. So I have a section where Harriet Tubman and then three other freedom fighters from Jewish and Arabic histories, Sol Hachuel, Inyor Nat Khan, and Doña Gracia Nazi, and they all merge at one point. So they're individual figures, and then they become this one essence, spirit, who Zazu meets and learns from. So I chose people whose commitments to the environment, perhaps more humanitarian based specifically, where it was so deeply personal, where their lives were so deeply integrated into what it was that they were fighting for, where their sense of place in the world was oriented around helping and understanding the depth of our interconnectedness and risking everything based on that, and finding a deep sense of spiritual intelligence in that practice of being alive in order to work together and to make the world a better place.
You drop little nuggets of knowledge, like when Zazu rides his whale to Turkey, to Izmir. You remind the readers that Homer, the Greek storyteller, lived there. And so you're traveling back and forth through time in the book and make things seem very immediate, even though a lot of what you're talking about is ancient times.
Yes, yes. So in the end, I have a timeline which is not linear, because time is not linear, as we know. It's in the shape of a Mobius strip. And the timeline is an understanding of how the connection between when the Jews were being burned at the stake, for example, because of the Catholic monarchy refusing difference, cultural difference, religious difference in that case, how that then relates to fossil fuel addicted economies. So that's represented visually in the timeline. For me, that's one of the exciting reasons why we're alive, because we're alive in this continuum, in this constant back and forth between different time frames, but where the past is not the past, the future is not the future, but the future is absolutely integrated into multiple pasts and multiple presents. And that, for me, in the face of all of the devastation around us, the environmental devastation and humanitarian devastation, that for me gives me a sense of empowerment and a sense of direction in these multiple time frames, where we are connected to our ancestors and to multiple others' ancestors, where we're not isolated, we're not alone. And that's really the baseline of the book in so many ways, that we are continually informed and supported, and our intuition is fed through these other voices, these other experiences from cultures that we have no idea in our conscious world, but our ancestral memory or our willingness to be open to the unknown can guide us.
Iran and Iraq are also on his journey. I wonder, what are your thoughts about the world's youngest country, the United States, one of the world's youngest countries, working hard to destroy one of the very oldest countries, Iraq or Mesopotamia?
Yeah. Again, goosebumps, the goosebumps. Yeah, it's not just our species hubris, it's this country. And again, how do we constantly hold ourselves accountable and see our complicity, our sense of intimacy, responsibility as a motivation to galvanize us, to work collectively, work individually and collectively, to resist this from becoming just normalcy, just taken for granted that our standard of living propels these kinds of insane power dynamics between the United States and other countries, and to recognize that total obscenity, as you just said, the youngest country or one of the youngest and one of the oldest, and to reevaluate our sense of how we play a role through consumerism, through how we raise children. That's what I wanted to go back to, that how we share our sense of entitlement with our children, how do we take on these realities as creative coalitional projects, educational projects, lived educational projects. And when I say project, I don't mean hobby. I mean a lived commitment to social change, to social justice.
Zazu meets and converses with many animals in the book. How did you choose the animals to include? Is there an archetypal aspect to it?
I think for me, probably I'm much more simplistic and naive. And I'd love to learn more about what various animals represent. For me, it was two things. One, the idea of interspecies communication and the depth of what we can learn by understanding, for example, that plants have nervous systems. The way a forest communicates can become a model for us, like a cultural biomimicry. So that on one hand, and then on the other hand, the husky, I grew up with a husky, Rosie. I had her from the age of 4 to 14, and she was my sister growing up through all of the major changes that I experienced as a child, including heavy-duty anti-Semitism. She was always right there with me.
Your rock.
My rock, my dog, Rock, yes. And then the whale, Zazu, my real son, Zazu, who's 10 years old, when he was little, would dream about traveling on a whale. So that gave me the idea originally.
Fantastic. I learned a lot from your book. One thing I learned is that there were Jewish pirates.
Yes. Yeah.
I never knew.
Yeah. Again, the multiplicity of Jewish histories, of any cultural minority's history, and in this case, Jewish histories. The pirates came from when the post-expulsion from the monarchy in late 1400s, a lot of them were trying to retaliate against the Spanish Armada and also were attempting to intervene in the colonialism and in the imperialist agendas of the monarchy. So for example, in the Caribbean, a lot of those pirates were working with the indigenous peoples to try and resist the Catholic missionary takeovers.
In your end notes, which are very dense with attributes, you reference organizations that think they are helping or are supposed to be helping with ecological concerns and biodiversity and are actually doing more harm. Can you talk about that?
So that's one aspect of greenwashing. We're just perpetuating intense consumer culture by replacing one hegemony with another, one overarching form of consumerism with another. So fossil fuels with renewables. So with certain organizations, a lot of this has to do with scale because money, unfortunately, gets to be a motivating factor, a survival factor for so many nonprofits. So often a nonprofit's agenda needs to conform in order for it to survive. When we're living within this capitalist framework, so many of our values are distorted without looking at the fundamental reasons why we got to this place to begin with. And that's what so much of the book is about, looking at how these roots are interconnected and how do we begin to disentangle the roots so that we are not just constantly replicating the same abuses and spiraling further down. Individual action and corporate accountability and infrastructural redesign is not being addressed. Just as an underlying call for action for all of us to incorporate children's experiences and perspectives and highlighting our possibility to unlearn what we think we know as adults and encouraging the empathy that potentially is innate in children. How can we creatively take on the terrors and the fears around us and take risks together? Intellectual, spiritual, parenting, consumer risks, lifestyle behavior risks.
That was Kara Judea Al-Hadef, author of Zazu Dreams, Between the Scarab and the Dung Beetle, a cautionary fable for the Anthropocene era, illustrated with paintings by Micaela Amatu Amato. The book is being translated into Spanish and is also the basis for a screenplay and future performance, for which Al-Hadef is looking for creative collaborators. You can find a link on our website. Thank you for tuning in to this week's edition of Locomotion. I'm Kate Redmond.